This is Billy Flynn with GeekRadioDaily.com. Ding! And you're listening to episode 24 of Murder at Avedon Hill.
Welcome to the podcast presentation of Murder at Avedon Hill, the Chronicles of Aramis Cragan, written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Well, hello and welcome to episode 24 of Murder at Avedon Hill. I'm recording this intro at a Panera's in Huntersville, North Carolina, so pardon the background noise. 1 year ago, on June 13, 2007, I released episode 1 of the novel. 95,000 words and 24 episodes later, here we are. Chapter 23, which is what you'll be listening to today, is the finale of part 1 of the novel. We're about 60 to 65% through the novel, word count wise, and other than the fact I thought we'd be at the end of the novel by this point, I couldn't be more pleased. Over 5,000 people have given this podcast a try, and over 3,000 have stuck with me thus far. I thank each and every one of you for making this year the most satisfying one of my life, creatively speaking, and I could chatter all day about this, but I'm not going to do that. I do have a couple items. First, I wanted to plug Murder at Avedon Hill's initial nomination at the Parsec Awards website. The Parsec Award is the most prestigious award for speculative fiction in podcast form. Someone took the time to nominate us, and if you'd like to help me out, please visit the page for this podcast, which is parsecawards.com/node/288. You can go there, leave a comment supporting this podcast's nomination. I know some authors are asking listeners to make multiple submissions for the same podcast novel, but I don't want to confuse the issue. I think if people leave comments at the page I just listed, we'll get the point across that people are enjoying the podcast, and maybe Murder at Avedon Hill will make it to the next round of nominations. Lastly, as most of you might know, I'm doing a live reading of the chapter you are about to listen to through Ustream.tv. If you are listening to this, it should have already happened. But if things go right, you should be able to view a recording of the video reading over at my website. Of course, if it was a colossal disaster, please disregard what I just said. So, on to the podcast. Today's guest voices are Ray LaMond as Lila and James Ziesel as the innkeeper Talik Boar. If you enjoy this chapter, please consider leaving a review on iTunes or at patiobooks.com. I've had several entries in the contest I've got going on until the end of June, so please visit the website for more information on that. But now, it's time. Thanks once again for listening. And now, episode 24 of Murder at Avedon Hill.
Chapter 23, Back at the Inn. The icon of Artus, the child of war. They will tire. It is then we will strike.
They are Turim, Theroik. What if they never tire?
We will nip at their heels. We will cut off a finger here, a toe there. Even a horde will tire of losing appendages, eventually.
Theroik Ironblade.
The two men walked back to the inn in silence, both exhausted from the long day. Aaron favored his back, still tender from the clawing it had taken at the hands of the vampire that had once been Edvard Avedon. While they walked, Aramis checked the bandage on his own arm. The healing salve Richard had given them was doing its work. The pain had lessened, and the throbbing in his muscles had subsided.
Marissa does have talent.
The now full moon was high on its journey through the night. The Avedon Hill Cemetery was behind them and out of sight. But Aramis sensed that Father Joris was there, watching over the town as its two visitors made their way back to their room for a short night's sleep. Wake up, dear child. Lila awoke with a start. She had been waiting for the inn's only customers to return and had fallen asleep on the stairs, head leaning against the wall.
I'm sorry, Sir Aramis. Are you just getting in for the night?
Yes, we are. Be a dear and warm up whatever Talik had planned for us for dinner. And if you do not mind, please draw me a bath. It did not matter that it was deep into the night. Lila smiled, eager to serve.
Of course, Sir Aramis. Straight away.
She nodded and scampered down the stairs. So, how do we root out a vampire? Aaron had regained his voice now that they were back in the room.
That, young Aaron, is a good question. As the creature that murdered Edward Avedon is most likely a vampire master, it can pass itself off as human. And since we have met everyone of note here in town, it is either someone that is very good at hiding their secret, or our vampire has the ability to enter and leave town without being noticed.
There is a third option. Aramis raised an eyebrow.
Yes, Edward could have met this vampire outside of town.
But only if Edward had his own methods for getting in and out of town.
Come again?
When Cletus let me look at his logbooks, I was looking more at Greta's comings and goings. But I did my best to memorize who used the town gate over the last few weeks. Edward Avedon never left town through the front gate, unless Cletus neglected to record it in his logbook.
And I do not think that is the case.
Aaron scowled a little.
Me either. So we have two paths to follow, one to find the vampire who turned Edward, and the other to find out who killed Greta.
Aaron had had enough.
Are you kidding, Aramis? You still believe that something other than a vampire killed Greta Platt? After what we encountered this evening, it should be obvious that either Edward Avedon killed Greta, or the vampire that turned him killed her. Or there is a third option.
Aaron collapsed on his bed, careful to land on the side opposite his injury.
That Greta's murder had nothing to do with vampires, even though her blood-drained body tells us otherwise. The monk paused while removing his robes to shake a finger in Aaron's direction.
We never saw Greta's body. Aaron rubbed his face with his hands.
Even so, we know there was very little blood where her body was found.
We believe her murderer entered the courtyard, most likely from the tunnels underneath Avedon Hill, attacked her, drained her blood through the wounds on her neck, and then escaped. And you think a vampire wasn't involved?
Aramis stood by the bathtub in the middle of the room, now wearing a long white shirt that nearly reached the floor. You are absolutely right. The only way I know that so much blood could have been removed from her body was by someone or something sucking it out. It is what I do not know that bothers me so much.
What is that?
The lack of blood troubles me. Even a vampire feasting slowly is going to leave a bloody corpse. And this killer did not have time to linger over his meal. Next, why would a vampire master choose to kill Greta Platt? And why kill her in the middle of the manor's courtyard? It still comes down to a question of why.
Maybe Greta discovered who the vampire was, so the vampire was forced to kill. The creak of the room's only door silenced Aaron in mid-comment. Lila entered carrying a platter of food. The smile on her face indicated she had not overheard their conversation.
Aaron stood and began walking over to take the platter from her. The attractive maid giggled slightly as Aaron half-tripped over the backpack he had left in the middle of the floor. The prince failed to keep a flush from blooming across his face.
I'll be right back with your hot water, gentlemen.
Nearly a psych later, both men were ready for bed. Aramis checked Aaron's back. He figured Aaron's wounds would be completely healed in just a few days. Both men required sleep, but Aramis knew Aaron needed it more so.
I will take the first watch. Sleep while you may.
Aaron didn't argue. Aramis grabbed a chair and placed it against the wall opposite to the room's only window. Once he sat, the door to the room was on Aramis's left, and the window overlooking the town to the north was directly in front of him. Both door and window were locked, but Aramis was not willing to rest his eyes just yet. Aaron opened his eyes and looked around him, still groggy from sleep. But he wasn't in his room any longer. He stood outside the library. The stars were bright, as was the full moon on this cloudless night, and he could feel grass beneath his bare feet. In fact, Aaron found he was completely naked. Thankfully, though, he was oblivious to the cold. He knew he had to be dreaming. His back felt completely healed. He thought of Aramis and how he had described dreamwalking. I must be walking the bridge again. He heard his voice clearly when he spoke, but the only response was the sound of the wind through the scattered trees surrounding the library. Aaron didn't appreciate his nakedness, even if the freezing temperatures of an Avedon Hill evening were not part of his dream. This fact triggered Aaron's desire to control more of his dream. He concentrated in an attempt to evoke clothes for his lower body. The thought of someone seeing him hunched over at the shoulders, staring at his torso, straining to make clothing appear, did little to help his concentration. After a few moments, he stopped. Naked it is, then. Maybe Sarah Tremaine will show up. That would certainly be better than the dream I had last night. From where he stood, Aaron studied the library's windows since they were in his direct line of sight. They were well tinted, like the stained glass in many of the temples he had visited. If there were candles lit within the library, Aaron couldn't tell. He took two steps towards the door, but his progress was halted by a pulse of energy. It struck him in the chest like a gust of heavy wind. He staggered, understanding instinctively that the pulse had originated from inside the library. But even as Aaron started to process this information, a second blast erupted. The concussion knocked Aaron from his feet. Following this, seemingly out of order, every window in sight shattered and exploded out, sending shards and slivers of glass over and onto Aaron as he lay on the ground. As Aaron rolled over, doing his best to protect himself from the glass all around him, he realized the only sound he had heard was the glass breaking and flying through the air. Whatever had caused the explosion had made no noise at all. Aaron stood, half expecting to find cuts from the broken glass on his body. Instead, Aaron found himself, unmarked and uninjured, standing not in front of the library, but in front of the smithy. Again, determined to control more of his dream, Aaron walked into the smithy. Inside, Aaron found two men, or at least one small man, and one giant that had to be Herjar. Aaron assumed the smaller man was Herjar's apprentice, Alis Wink. They both stood at the edge of a large table. They spoke to each other, but Aaron couldn't hear anything except the fire from the forge. On the table was some sort of garment or loose material. The two men were oblivious to Aaron's presence. Aaron approached and studied the garment.
As Aaron stared, the garment began changing shape before his eyes. Aaron could not pinpoint what the garment was. A dress, an apron, a cloak? There was one thing he did know, however. The garment was stained with blood. Aaron reached out to touch the piece of clothing. Aaron found himself lying on his back, arms extended above him. Unlike his two earlier dreams, Aaron now could not hear anything at all. In fact, he could not tell where he was, because in addition to the silence, there was no light. Am I deaf and blind? Aaron tried to climb to his feet and found that he was lying on a bed and not on the floor. He also realized that he was wearing the night clothes he had worn to bed. What in Aja's name? Aaron immediately determined two things. First, even though he spoke aloud, no sound reached his ears. Second, and even more troubling, was that he knew he was not dreaming. The prince blinked, staring where he believed the room's window should be. Something had to be covering it, as he could not even make out an outline of the window through the blackness of the room. He stretched his arms out in front of him and tried to make his way to the window, to uncover it, to let the moonlight in. Wait, Aramis had started a fire. Aaron turned to find the fireplace. He was met with a darkness that left him no other conclusion. Magic? Aaron was turned around now. He knew not which direction he faced. Aramis! His shout did not penetrate the silence around him. Something solid struck Aaron's right leg just below his waist, dropping the prince to one knee. Before he could even attempt to figure out what had happened, he felt something strike his neck, and then he was forced to the ground. Aaron struggled, but a strong hand or arm pushed down on his chest. He gasped for air. He tried to raise his arms, but could not. Blood rushed to his throbbing head, and Aaron knew something was against his neck. Something sharp. Something draining. No. I won't go like this. This isn't right. But Aaron found he could no longer move a muscle. Even in the black of the room, Aaron felt a different darkness creep in from the corner of his eyes. He was dying. A light began to appear above him.
So this is how it ends.
First a flicker, growing brighter until it was more brilliant than the lamp at Kalin's perch. He did not know whether to reach out for it or not, but it did not matter. His arms were stone. The light pulsed brightly, but then began to fade. Try as he might, Aaron could not reach out for it. Aaron gradually realized that it wasn't the light that was fading. It was his ability to see the light. One last time, he tried to strike whatever was attacking him, or to at least see what it was. But it was too late. Aramis had nearly fallen asleep in his chair when the light from the fire began dimming before his eyes. The monk, assuming it was a trick of his tired mind, shook his head in an attempt to clear it. When the light continued to fade, Aramis stood and stretched his legs, intending to check the fire. Moments later, the entire room was black as pitch.
By Dobbin!
Aramis leaped forward, knowing there were at least 5 paces between his chair and the tub in the center of the room, and realized in doing so that he had made no sound at all.
Silence and darkness.
Aramis reached out with his mind in an attempt to contact Aaron or to touch the mind of whatever else was in the room, but the unnatural dark was somehow affecting his connection to the river. Aramis Cregan was no sorcerer, but he was not without other links to the magic that flowed through the land. He reached into the folds of his robes and pulled out a gold medallion and held it out in front of him. He concentrated on the piece of metal he could not see
instinctively calling forth a power that he himself had imbued into the round metal form when he had forged it 30 years before. The former Aaronic advisor wasn't sure what would happen. He felt the medallion grow warm in his hand. A sphere of light he could only sense pulsed out, growing larger as he focused his energies on the metallic disc. In moments, the growing orb of light reached his head. Once it did, he could see the bright light emanating from his hand. He edged forward as the sphere continued to grow. The darkness began to recede. Once the orb was large enough to reach the floor, it began pulsating out in different directions. Tendrils of light extended from the sphere. The black began flowing backwards. It reminded Aramis of smoke, only flowing in reverse. The sphere of light reached the fireplace. The light from the medallion met the flames of the fire, and the resulting flash flared up the chimney. The sound of the blaze reached the monk's ears. Aramis determined that the darkness had to be flowing back towards whomever or whatever had created it. He also understood that whatever it was, it had to be in the corner beyond Aaron's bed. In the moment between making his choice to charge into the middle of the receding black and the act of doing it, an explosion of sound filled the room. Aramis lost hold of the medallion as his hands flew to his ears. A day from Aramis's youth rushed into his mind. He had once hidden in a bell tower, not knowing that the song of Artus was about to be rung. As had happened on that occasion, Aramis fell to his knees, hoping his eardrums had not burst. The light of the medallion sucked back into itself, as if someone had thrown it into a chest and closed the lid. But the magical darkness had left the room as well. Aramis shook off the ringing in his ears and blinked as his eyes tried to adjust to the new levels of light in the room. Aramis had a sigh in his good hand. He couldn't see anyone in the room, most importantly, the prince. Aaron! Aramis ran forward to the window, even though it was closed. He did not see anyone outside on the streets. He turned back and finally saw an unmoving Aaron on the floor. Aramis's view of the prince had been blocked by the bed. Aramis rushed to Aaron's side and placed his hand on Aaron's chest. The monk now saw two small jagged wounds on Aaron's neck. Blood flowed from the cuts. Aramis used the edge of his robes to cover Aaron's neck and staunch the flow of blood. Before Aramis could check Aaron further, he was interrupted by a scream. It was Lila, standing at the open door to the room.
Iberian's light!
Talakbor yelled as he rushed past Lila into the room.
What happened? We heard noises and then you yelled.
Talak finally saw that Aramis was holding his robe against Aaron's neck.
By the children!
Talak fell silent as soon as he saw the murder in Aramis's eyes. Go now, Talak. Get Red and bring him here. Do not say anything to anyone else. Talak didn't move, trying to see if Aaron was breathing. Talak, go! Talak ran out of the room, pulling a trembling Lila behind him. Aramis knew he had to calm down. He couldn't help anyone in his current state, least of all Aaron. Aramis concentrated on his heartbeat, forcing it to slow to a normal rate. He looked around, trying to determine how Aaron's attacker had entered and exited the room. Momentarily disregarding his own need for calmness, Aramis growled.
Hide, whomever or whatever you are. Darkness will protect you no longer. Now I come for you.
Balticon 42, T. Morris issued a challenge.
From this moment, I am declaring war on every podcasting author
out there!
T now refers to himself as the Uber Nemesis, eager to take on all podcast authors. Clearly, T did not think through his decision.
Looky here, an email from Holyfield. Threatens to kill Father Joris, huh? Yeah, bring it on, Avedon boy. Subject, lines for murder at Avedon Hill.
Hey, T, hope you liked that skit with Lester and Pip. All in good fun, right?
Yeah. Killing my character in all of your podcast novels. Do you think that will stop the Uber Nemesis?
I've attached some new lines for episode 26. No, I didn't kill you off. Of course, that was just a joke. I need you, Sarge.
There you go. Let's see what changes you've made.
Joris has vampires to hunt.
Some slight changes. Just minor edits, really. Wanted to introduce a new character, Giganto.
Giganto.
New line, Father Joris. What do you want? I must leave for the cemetery. Evil waits for no one.
Evil waits for no one. Ooh, I like that. I can sell that one.
Line, Giganto. You sure do have a pretty mouth.
Pretty mouth. Squeal like a pig.
Damn you, Holyfield!
Will T. Morris become Giganto's bitch in Murder at Avedon Hill? Will P.G. Holyfield make a sudden appearance as a eunuch in Moravi Remastered? Visit pgholyfield.com and moravi.net to find out more.
You've been listening to Murder at Avedon Hill, a podcast novel written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Please visit pgholyfield.com for more information on this novel and the author. Most of the music in this podcast generously provided by Shira Common through Magnatune.com. Magnatune.com, they are not evil. Additional music generously provided by Kevin MacLeod through his website at incompetech.com. Be sure to check out Murder at Avedon Hill at podiobooks.com, and if you are so inclined, please post a review at iTunes, at Podcast Pickle, or at podiobooks.com. Audio comments about the podcast can be left on the Cairn line at 704-315-5884, or go to pgholyfield.com and click on the Call Me button to leave comments. This podcast is copyright 2007-2008 by P.G. Holyfield and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license.